Welcome back to another edition of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, El Ariel, and we can be reached on all the streaming platforms, Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Android, and more. And we're also at musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S, podcast.com. Hope everybody's doing well, surviving the holiday onslaught as we slide on out of 2017, getting that shopping done for the holidays. And speaking of shopping, last week I had the wonderful pleasure of interviewing Cordell Miles, who is the independent record store owner of Music Masters Worldwide, just outside of downtown Chicago. This great indie record store has vinyl, it has CD, cassette, even 8-tracks, just a wonderful collection. You can also order online at musicmastersworldwide.com. Anyway, he had just such an interesting journey. He started out as a DJ, rapper, MC in SoCal, and then ended up as an owner of this indie record store, and just talked about the importance of vinyl, the importance of still having sort of physical music product in our digital age. So just really good stuff. This week, I have kind of a twofer, or I almost want to say threefer, in one person. His name is Tim Hare. Just a really incredible journey. Started out as a bass player fresh out of high school and was touring the UK with a band. Then he went on to work on tours, behind the scene tours for Wiz Khalifa, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Smashing Pumpkins, for other bands. He also became Mick Jones' personal assistant. That's Mick Jones as in the founding member of Foreigner. So just an incredible journey, and now he's working at Alibi Music Library. So he really gives a very good in-depth behind the scenes of what it's like to travel with a band, what it's like to go on tour, and all the machinations, like how the sausage is made, basically, when a tour goes on, when you go to a concert, like what's happening all behind the scenes, how to get into that industry, and then also about music libraries, what they're all about, how you can get into music libraries, writing for music libraries, that kind of thing. So without further ado, and I'll stop my yapping, here's Tim to talk about it. But before that, of course, I've got to feature one of his amazing songs. Here's Sunset Creeps. Hey, how'd you get that music job? It's so nice to have you.
I'm really excited to be here. Thank you very much.
Aw. All right. So why don't you tell me a little bit about your childhood, but just in terms of music. So what kind of influence music had on your life? What kind of household you grew up in? That kind of thing.
This sounds cliche, but it's totally true. I guess I was just kind of born with it. My parents have always told me my entire life that my first word was guitar.
That's crazy.
Yeah, agreed. I had guitars as a little kid, but there's photos of me being totally naked and having an acoustic guitar, but I couldn't play it because I was too little. So I would stand on the acoustic guitar and that was my stage, and I would play a tennis racket instead. The first presents I ever asked for as a little kid was I wanted, Sade on tape and Dire Straits on tape.
What an eclectic child.
Yes. And I'm very blessed. My parents are huge music fans. It was just always playing in our house. I can still recall a fishing trip when I was about 5 or 6 years old. And just in the car ride on that trip, my dad was playing A Hard Day's Night. He loves Tom Petty. That's probably his favorite artist. So I get a lot of classic rock from my father. My mom was really into like soul music and funk and pop, loves David Bowie, loves Michael Jackson. So I get a lot of that from her. And then my stepdad, who came into my life when I was about 6 or 7, he was really into like indie and alternative college rock. Like Weezer was a band he really liked because he grew up, he was really into punk rock. So I got a lot of my punk influence from him. So through them, I just was always exposed to a lot of different styles of music, and I just really gravitated towards it. But I didn't actually play anything up until, like, really, I took some piano lessons, I had guitars, I never really played them. But we moved around a lot when I was a kid. I got to Newton, Massachusetts, where you're from, and I was the new kid. And I was home on a Friday night playing air guitar, and my mom thought I looked really pathetic, and she felt very sorry for me because I was, like, supposed to be going out and going to parties and meeting people, and it was Friday, and I didn't know anyone yet, so I just was at home in the living room, like, playing air guitar to Blink-182. And so when I was 16, for my 16th birthday, my parents bought me a Squire, like, bass starter pack, and I started playing bass at 16, and I never looked back. It was the one thing that my parents didn't have to tell me to practice. My schoolwork definitely suffered because the minute I walked in the door, I was down in the basement just practicing. And so I started playing guitar and bass at 16, and just like it just took over my life. And you know, I'm 33 now, and that's all I do is music. I've just been in music ever since that. So that was like the big epiphany moment for me. My big eureka moment was once I started playing bass. My favorite band ever is Queen. So I played a lot of Queen. I was in punk and hardcore bands in high school, so I was playing like Save the Day type music. I really liked their bass player. Love the Beatles, the Beach Boys. So I was listening to a lot of that once I started playing bass and just trying to kind of understand the instrument a bit more and just understand music a bit more. And I had a teacher who was very casual, but he was really influential in my life. I would play him a punk song I wanted to learn, and he would go, okay, we're going to learn this, but first I want you to learn this riff, and he would make me learn like a Dick Dale riff or something. And It would basically be almost the exact same riff that I wanted to learn. So he was kind of ingraining the history of music into me while also teaching me stuff I wanted to learn. But I didn't read music up until I got to college, and then that's when I taught myself how to read.
So when you were in high school and you're playing in these bands, did you have any sort of path or like clear cut idea of what you wanted to do? Or was it like, okay, I'm going to go to college and I'm going to hone my music skills even more? Like what did you do?
Great question. I actually didn't go to college till I was 24 because my career path was, I want to be a rock star. Our final day of classes in high school, I went over to a friend's house and we watched Almost Famous, the Cameron Crowe film. And there's a scene where the lights go out and the manager's like, from Michigan, Stillwater. And like the audience like erupts and the lights come on, the band started playing. And I was like, that's what I want to do. Like that's me. Like I want to be playing music. I want to be touring. I really want to be a rock and roll star, essentially. So I joined bands. I got an apartment in Boston. I moved out of my parents' house, and I joined a band called Baby Strange. I was about 19 or 20. All the guys were a lot older. I had to sneak into clubs in Boston and New York because you're supposed to be 21 or older, and I was underage. So I would always carry my gear up to the security guard and say, like, hey, I can't reach my wallet. Do you mind if I just put my stuff in? I'll come back and show it to you. And they would say, yeah, no problem. And then I just would never go back out. Like that was how I snuck in to playing all these places I shouldn't have been playing. I just wanted to be in rock bands. And so I joined Baby Strange. We were kind of a glam rock band. And we moved to England and we toured around there on and off.
Can I ask you a quick question? Sorry to interrupt you, but I wanted to get an idea. When you graduated from high school, like how did you find this band? Did you have to audition for them? Like, did you go on Craigslist? Like, how did you actually find this band and everything?
I got a job right across the street from Berklee where I always wanted to go. I knew at some point I would go to the Berklee College of Music, and I worked at like a cafe essentially, and the singer of this band came in all the time, and he actually just liked the records I played. So I would play like Erykah Badu or Blur, and he loved all those artists. So he started talking to me one day, and he's like, you know, are you a musician? I said, yeah, I play bass. And he said, oh, cool. Fast forward 6 months, we've become friends, and they did a lineup change, and they got rid of their bass player, and he asked me to audition. And I went and played with him and the drummer and didn't hear anything for like 3 months, and I thought I didn't get it. And then I got a text message, and he said, hey, we're playing a show. We're headlining New Year's Eve at the Middle East, the club I'm sure you're familiar with him in Boston. He's like, we're headlining the Middle East New Year's Eve. You have to go buy a suit. And our first rehearsal is like in a week. I just was so excited. Like this, I had played in bands that it was really cool. I had played in bands that, you know, gigged around and stuff. But this was like, you know, we had merch. We had a record. We had a licensing deal. Like we had records that you could go into Newbury Comics and buy. It felt like it was my first like real band. It changed my life being in that band. It totally did.
That's so cool. Okay, so you're in this band. You're going to New York. Then you guys moved to London.
Well, we moved to Nottingham, which is just a couple hours north. It was in the days of MySpace, so we would just email promoters, and we got gigs booked constantly, and we had a really crappy van that broke down all the time. Luckily, our flat, or apartment, as they say, was right above like an auto body shop. We were friends with the guy who owned it, so like every couple weeks he would just fix our van. I was really young. Like I said, I was like 20. I was probably 20, 21 at this point. And I remember when we got to England, like I maybe had like $500 to my name, and I kind of had a panic attack because I was like, I don't really know what I'm doing. You know, like how do we survive in England on tour? But luckily the guys were older, and they're kind of like older brothers, and they just really took care of a lot of things, and I got to just play bass every day, and it was a blast. I mean, I miss those days to a certain extent, but you could just do it. And I remember there was a British band that we played with, and they said that it was a very American idea that you guys could just show up and like tour and just do it. They're like, British bands would never do that. Like we'd be too nervous or reserved to just go for it. But we did, and I think because we did that, it made me realize like you can figure anything out. You just have to do it, and then you'll find a way to survive.
Yeah, that's really cool. So, but something happened obviously that made you go back and go to college.
Yeah, so we broke up.
Okay, well, I'll do it.
In England, we had a lot of like internal strife, typical band stuff. We were fighting about money and creative differences, et cetera. And we broke up, and I didn't know what to do. And so I had to call my mom. I was broke, and I said, can you fly me home? And so I flew back to Boston. Three of us were going to start another band, and I kept having this reoccurring dream that I was stuck in another country, and I couldn't get home. And this is a true story. I had a dream, and I was stuck in a hotel room, and I turned around, and John Lennon was laying on a bed. And I was talking to John Lennon in my dream, and I said, what do I do? And he's like, you know what you need to do? Just figure it out. And then I was like, what's it like being dead? And he was like, that's not that big of a deal. And then I woke up. And so
that's hilarious. I mean, very prophetic dream, but that is hilarious that that's your big question to John Lennon.
I know, right? Like, those are the two things I talked to him about.
What's it like being dead?
And I remember when he said, like, it's not that big of a deal, like, I woke up kind of like, oh, maybe it's not that big of a deal when you die.
Unbelievable. That's awesome.
So I wrote an email to the band members, kind of taking the cheap way out. And I just said, hey, guys, like, I'm going to go back to school. And I applied to Berkeley. And I knew when I got to Berkeley that I wanted to study like arranging and film scoring. And I went into contemporary writing and production, which allowed me to do a little bit of all of that. But like, I could barely read a note when I got to Berkeley. And then when I left, I wrote for a 30-piece orchestra. So I definitely learned while I was there. Yeah, we broke up, and we're still friends. That band, Baby Strange, we did a couple reunion shows in Boston, and we headlined back-to-back nights at the Middle East, and then a couple of the guys were just out here in Pasadena in March, and we cut a record for the first time.
Oh, shit, that's great.
So it was super cool, yeah, and like life has a funny way of coming full circle sometimes, so we're all still really good friends. We're actually talking about going back to England at some point next year and touring for a few weeks and playing our new record. So that would be a lot of fun.
Cool.
I would,
yeah. Absolutely. So you sounds like you though you really immersed yourself in school and just got like were you there 4 years? Yeah.
Yeah, I was there all 4 years, and I was paying for it. You know, my parents help when they can, but you know, I'm probably going to pay student loans till the day I meet John Lennon in real life. So I really just valued being there, and I knew I was learning a brand new skill set. It was like trying to learn a language, reading music and writing music. And so I just knew I was kind of against the grain. And I was a little bit insecure at Berkeley because I was older. And I would see these 18-year-old kids who were just light years ahead of me, not just in terms of their technical ability, but their skill set. Like their ears were better trained. They understood music theory better. So I really wanted to try and get myself up to speed. And it was really humbling going to Berkeley. Like, I thought I was a pretty good bass player in Baby Strange. And, you know, we would play and I'd get complimented. And I think my ego had inflated a little bit. And then I got to Berkeley and all my teachers were like, yeah, you suck. And so that that being humbled right out of the gate, I think, made me want to, like, really dive in to music even more. Because I was like, all right, you know, these guys are amazing players. They tell me I suck. I'm probably not that good. I got a long way to go. And so I really, really immersed myself in my classes and in learning how to read and write music and score and orchestrate. And a lot of my early stuff was just terrible. I just didn't know what I was doing. And then by the time, like now at 33, I just did a short film. I kind of know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. So it's a constant process. But Berkeley, was hugely influential on me, and I think some of the courage that I gained came from that dream I had about John Lennon, where it was just like, you know, it's going to be all right, just do it. So.
And I'm curious too about, you know, your experience in Boston and Berkeley, because I think it's, I don't know, in my experience, it's like, it's kind of a different animal. It's very formal, linear progression too. The arts are treated like, in a good way, but like the arts are treated almost like medical school or becoming a lawyer, like you do this, 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 and then you do this. Did you feel like that was kind of how it was at Berkeley? Like they were like, we're preparing you for this particular career, and these are all the things that you need, and then you're going to fly out to LA, and then you're going to start here. And like, what was that like?
Yeah, they didn't really have that like toolkit or like starter pack, you know, like here's the lunchbox and the tour map and here's how it's going to go for you. It was a little bit looser. Mm-hmm. I did get frustrated at times because Berkeley places a huge emphasis on jazz. And while I like jazz music, it's not the most prevalent at the moment. So I would kind of argue with my teachers, like, can we learn other things aside from just jazz? Because I can't take half of what you're teaching me and go have a career with it. I think that's just because I had such a weird path to get to Berkeley, like being in touring and being a little bit older, I didn't have a sense when I got there that Berkeley was going to even prepare me for that next step, in the sense that like it would kind of pave a way for me. I always in the back of my head knew like, I'm going to learn as much as I can, and then I got to do things my own way. That's just kind of how I'm wired.
That's cool. That's cool. So, okay. So you graduate from Berkeley. Now what? Do you move immediately to LA, or what happened?
No. So again, this as will be the running theme, my career just went off in a completely weird direction. I graduated, I bartended in college to help pay rent and stuff. And I was just bartending, and I didn't really know what to do in Boston. I didn't feel like there were a lot of music jobs. There was like kind of one production house that you could write for. Mm-hmm. And I didn't feel that I was up to snuff at that point to like even apply there. And I think some of it was fear, to be quite honest with you. I was bartending, and I quit the bar I was working at and literally was printing out resumes to go to other bars. And a friend called me and said, hey, I need someone to go on the Wiz Khalifa tour to take photos of our VIP people. He works for a company that's owned by Warner Music Group. And they did the kind of these like fan experience packages for, you know, like on top of the ticket, you pay like a couple extra $100 and you get to like meet your idol and get a poster and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And they needed a road rep for the Wiz Khalifa tour. And he was like, you have to leave I think he called me on like Thursday. He's like, you leave Tuesday and you're not going to be home for about 2.5 months.
But we're,
you know, we'll pay you a weekly salary, which was, you know, guaranteed money. Awesome. Mm-hmm. That's great. Like, I got to travel. You know, he's like, you'll travel. We'll pay for all that. You're going to be on a tour bus. And I was like, where do I sign up? And so I had a conference call with Warner. They sent me a note to go down to the bank to get notarized. I'd never notarized anything. Didn't even know you could do that. And Monday morning, I had a plane ticket to that got me to Happy Valley, where Penn State is. That was where the first show was. And they had never been on the road, so they couldn't really tell me what to do. So I just kind of had to figure it out. Once again, I just kind of had to show up and figure it out. And so I did that, and I did a few tours for artists. The company was called Artist Arena at the time. I did a few tours for Warner, and I wanted to have a career in music. So I would wake up early, and I'd go to the production office, and I would just kind of plant myself in the office, and I asked the assistant tour manager, like, hey, what can I do to help you? And so they started to – I was almost like – by the end of the tour, I was almost his assistant.
Wow, that's great. Chris Bragg.
Mm-hmm. Awesome guy, mentored me. And so I worked in touring for a couple of years, or about a year, I should say. I did four tours. And at the end of the final tour I did, I knew I wanted to move back to LA, where I'm from originally, and I knew I had to really dedicate myself to doing something. And the reason why I had another big epiphany moment was I ran the Boston Marathon the year that the bombs went off.
Oh, wow.
And I was incredibly close to both explosions, much closer to the second one. And it was just a wake-up call, like, hey, you're about to be 30 and you're not really going for it. You're not really making the most of your life. You're not really making the most of your skill set, and you don't have a career in music, really. You're going to have to kind of kick your ass into high gear. And so after I did that last tour, I was like, all right, I'm moving to L.A. I'm from a big family. My mom is one of 11, so I have a lot of aunts and uncles and cousins that live in Los Angeles and family friends. My dad lives out here, so I just kind of kicked around for a few months in L.A. trying to find a job in music, and then my bank account was running really low, and my morale was also running. that account was running really low as well. So I was looking at flights to go back to Boston, and I was going to bartend, try to get some more money, maybe make some connections, and then fly back at some point. I was going to move in with my parents. Guys had nothing, and I got an email from Artist Arena, and they said, the classic rock band Foreigner needs a full-time production assistant. Are you interested? And I was like, absolutely. And they said, cool, you have to go to Temecula, California on Friday. And I was like, I'm already in Temecula. I'm visiting my grandmother. And they were no way. So I went and I met them, and they liked me, and they said, all right, Tuesday you fly to Texas. We're going to give you a test run, see how you did. I did three shows, and at the end of the third show, the tour manager pulled me into his office and was like, you did a great job. We'll see you in Canada in a couple of weeks. You got the gig. And I did that for a whole year.
That's so cool.
It was really cool. I got switched over to being the personal assistant, day-to-day manager, or whatever the operative term is, for Mick Jones, who's a founding member and wrote all the songs, amazing guitar player. And so for about 9 months, it was just like Mick and I, and we traveled all over the world. So I'm in the car with him every day, and he's telling me stories about, you know, Junior Walker playing the sax solo on Urgent and how it's 34 takes that he cut together. And he, you know, I had dinner with Sammy Hagar, who Mick is friends with. I was standing in an airport in Germany, this little airport, and I turn around and there is Slash from Guns N' Roses.
Which was
just super rad. And I was like, hey, I know you know Mick Jones, because Slash was going to work on a project with Mick in the future. And I said, he's just coming out of the men's room, like, you know, hang on a second. And so I talked to Slash for like 10 minutes, and he was going to come to the show. He didn't make it. Which I was really upset about, because I told everyone, like, come and hang out with Slash tonight, and then he bailed on it. But I just got to kind of have this by proxy, like, Stillwater, almost famous moment at that point in my life. But I burnt out. That much travel, just kind of being on call 24/7. My girlfriend wasn't happy about me not being home, and I really missed Los Angeles. I was burnt out on traveling, and I was burnt out on managing, and I just wanted to be writing. And right. So after that tour ended, came back to LA and I called my aunt who worked in television, and she connected me with her friend Eric, who runs a small production music library called Sonic Librarian. And I went out to lunch with him, and he said, "Hey, if you know of anyone who wants to like work part time at Sonic, will you keep your ear to the ground?" And I said, "I'll do it." And he said, "Are you sure?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he's like, "I can't pay you what you're making in touring." And I was like, "That's all right. Like, you know, I really want to get into writing and learning about production music." And he's like, "Yeah, you can write as many cues as you want, and you're going to learn everything." And so I cut my teeth at Sonic, and I worked at Extreme, which is a pretty big production music library, for about 6 months, and just realized the desk job wasn't for me. And then I ended up at Alibi Music about 9 months ago, and I'm the director of operations there, and I also get to compose and stuff. So it's a dream gig. Like, I love our team. I love my boss. I get to work remote. I don't have to deal with traffic when I don't want to. But I had to take a big pay cut to get into production music, and it still hurts financially at the moment. I'm not paying those student loans off or my car off any faster, but it was a sacrifice I needed to make, and I am very happy that I did.
Wow. So I'm going to just back up a little bit, because I want, sure, just for our listeners, because I'm interested in Artist Arena a little bit. Just I think that aspect is kind of an unknown for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. You know, all the sort of levers and, you know, all the behind the scenes machinations that goes on behind a big name tour. So can you just talk, sure, about that a little bit, about like that experience and, you know, what you were, I know you were a personal assistant for Mick, but before that, when you were a PA, and what was that experience like? Like, what was the kind of day-to-day stuff?
For the Artist Arena stuff, it was pretty basic. I would get a list of all the VIP people at the show, and they had instructions on where to meet. But you did have to learn certain things. You know, I had to have a security guard pat them down, so I always had to get with the venue early and say, "Hey, you know, can you loan me 2 security guards for a couple hours while we do this thing?" You know, I had to find a space where we could do it. I would have to, you know, make sure that the artist was aware and that the artist would show up. And there were times when the artists were running really late, and you just have a group of people who are kind of pissed off that, you know, they had to show up really early and like the artist couldn't be bothered to be there. But stuff happens. Like, I remember we were in Vegas, and Wiz was going to be really late because he was shooting a music video and their plane got delayed. Like, they had to charter a private plane. And so I was like, "Hey, I'm sorry, he's not going to make it in time. We'll have to do it after the show." And people were like, "You know, that's going to be really late." And I said, "Well, I can't make him magically appear." So it's just, and the thing about touring in terms of the machinations, like you pull up, depending on how many trucks your tour has with gear and lighting, and you're just popping up a show every single day. And it's kind of amazing how big tours do it. There's a lot that can go wrong. There's a lot of moving pieces. Like, your crew has to be really, really tight. There are a lot of people running around backstage that you never see or think about when you're at a show, putting out fires and making sure that sound is working and the lights are working. And, you know, if there's a fight that happens, if someone gets thrown out, you know, we get made aware of all of that stuff, and it's chaos on a daily basis. When I was PAing, I mean, things would go wrong all the time, and you didn't really have time to settle down. Like, you would get up, go to catering, and eat breakfast, and then it was setting up the office. You know, we have to find a place where we can set up our office every day, and usually it's in a some sort of dressing room area, but, you know, you're setting up tables, setting up printers so you can print out passes for people. You have a runner who will kind of run errands for you because they're always a local and they know the area. So you try to figure out if there's a laundromat, you can do laundry. You run out of deodorant, you know, and you don't have time to go to Walmart really unless you have a day off. So you just would, you know, hand them $5 and have them go get you deodorant. You're just trying to make sure the show goes up as close to game time as possible with as few of problems as possible, and there's always problems. Mm-hmm. So it's just, it's really hectic, but it was also a lot of fun, especially because it was my first foray into like a music career, and a lot of the guys that I worked with, you know, their resumes were extensive for the tours they had done, and things have gotten a lot cleaner. you know, they had a lot of like debaucherous stories about stuff that would happen that you didn't really see anymore. And
I'm assuming it's gotten pretty corporatized, you know, with all the big.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, there's a lot of insurance involved with these big tours, you know, and there's corporate sponsors. And so
like
they
AIG
have to be
and all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they have to be mindful of that. The sort of, hopefully this would be interesting for your listeners, though I don't have a good answer, really. Like, the question I got asked the most, like, how do I get your job? How do I break into this industry? And it's, you just have to know people, and it's luck. Honestly, like, if my friend didn't ask me to go do that Wiz tour, and I didn't then say, hey, I kind of want to get into this a bit more, there's no, like, there's no message board or LinkedIn job posting about being on the road, whether it's working in the crew or being a tour assistant. So most people that I met who got into it, they started working at a local level, like working at local theaters, and you just meet people. And if you're good and a tour come, then, you know, and there's maybe, I don't know, 20 or 30 tour managers, like, and they're just bouncing between like two or three tours a year. And that's what keeps them paid, because you don't get paid when you're off. Like, you get paid off when the tour is running. But if, you know, hey, tour's done, we're off for 6 months, you know, U2's not going on tour for another 2 years, you got to make money,
right?
And you need to jump on another tour. And so you can work at a local level, work at local venues, you know, meet the sound guy, meet the lighting guy. You never know who they know, and sometimes the lighting guy has a touring gig, and if you're good, they'll say, like, hey, we need someone, like, do you want to come with? And that's sort of how you can break in, but it's really hard, and it's a very like incestual business. And so it's a lot of people bouncing around. And so it can be tough to get into, and it can also really wear on you, just like that much travel, and just chaos.
Right.
But it is a lot of fun, at times too. Like, you know, some of my best friends are guys I met on that tour, and just kind of by happenstance, like, really hit it off with Wiz Khalifa. And so he would pull me up on stage with like his friends every night. And like, we would dance in the background to one of his songs every night. And like, he would go to clubs and he would tell the tour manager, like, I'm taking Tim with me. Like, I want to show him a good time. And so I just like hung out with him and his entourage, and it was a lot of fun. You know, like, that's a pretty wild experience, and that's just like, that's not normal. It was just like, he and I hit it off, and he wanted to hang out occasionally. But, you know, I did tours with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. I never met Tom. I did tours with the Smashing Pumpkins, and I talked to Billy Corgan, like, once. So it's really rare to have, like, that type of intimate interaction.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was a really cool experience.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And it's funny because, you know, just talking with various guests on this podcast, it's like, the running theme is like, it's relationships, you know, you build relationships, and it's actually like, it's kind of a small town in that respect, you know, that you have to know someone, but once you do, it's kind of like, there is kind of this fairly intimate network of people, and that's why you don't want to burn any bridges or really piss anyone off, that kind of thing.
Right. Right. And it's, first off, just to pivot off your point, I've never met anyone in any industry who didn't get a job through a connection. Like, there's just too many people looking for jobs.
Yeah.
Your resume looks the exact same as just about everyone else's.
Right.
The reason your resume gets put on the top of the list by HR or in front of the tour manager for Foreigner is because somebody knows you and they vouch for you. Networking and relationships, especially in music, but really in any industry, is the name of the game. That's just what it's about. And you're right, you'd never want to burn any bridges. Even when I got out of touring, I got a couple of emails like within the first few months from people that I had met. And they said, hey, I heard you're not with Foreigner anymore. We could use a PA on this tour. Are you interested? And I said, no, I just started a new job. That I got those emails for a couple of months. And then once I was kind of out of the game for a few months, like, people forgot about me.
Right.
So even if I had wanted to go back into touring, I kind of would have had to have started over a little bit. And I had connection, but your spot goes away really fast and people forget about you really quickly. So if that is what you want to do, you have to make connections, and then you just have to say yes to a lot of things. Like, there's a lot, you just have to say yes. and kind of stay in that circle. Otherwise you get cut out. And it's not malicious. It's just, okay, like, I can't rely on you to do this. Totally understand why. No hard feelings at all. I got to go find people I can. And once your spot gets filled by those people.
Yeah. No, that makes total sense. Yeah. They have a job to do, and they don't have time to, like, yeah, they have, like, the shit needs to be done, and they need somebody good to fill the spot. And once it's filled, you move on. Yeah.
Right. And then every time your spot gets filled by somebody else, they have connections and they have friends that want to get into touring. So now it's even harder because there are other people vying for those spots. So, it was funny. Like, I was getting emails and I remember thinking, like, oh, I can always fall back on this. And then within a couple months, like, those emails started up and I thought, I don't know anyone. Like, I, a friend was like, hey, can you get me a touring job? And I was like, honestly, I don't know who to call. Like, I know, you know, this gig is full and this guy's not touring for a couple of years. He's getting married and having a kid. And, like, that was it. So it is a really interesting world. I'm trying to think of, like, any good insight into just, like, how it happens, but like, how a show comes together. One of the weirdest shows I was ever a part of is we did a Wiz Khalifa show in a parking lot. In, I think we were in Tallahassee, Florida. Like, it was like a bar that was on two stories, kind of like, it almost looked like a mini mall. Mm-hmm. And then there was a giant parking lot in the back, and we had to put a show up there. And so the stage guys built the stage, you know, we have the stage set up. They had the board, like the floor, you know, like the elevated floor was all that we were provided. And so they had to hang certain amount of lights. We couldn't do the screens, obviously, you know, the big, like, video projection screens we didn't do. Mm-hmm. So they just, in real time, like, walked out there and they said, like, shit, what the hell are we going to do? And then they just were like, okay, we can do this. We can't do this. You know, what are the measurements of this space? Okay, here's how we're going to do it. Here's where the kids are going to stand. So here's where the soundboard needs to go. And they just grabbed the local hands that showed up and told them what to do. And they made it happen. They made that show happen. Like, and they were doing it in real time, just solving problems. That is the biggest thing about touring, is you always have a problem. Things just don't go smoothly for myriad reasons. So you have to be able to hit curveballs. I remember working on a tour and the sound guy got fired in the first week because he was used to doing, like, theater shows where you could, like, set up every day and, like, really work it out over a period of time. And he struggled with the, you're always going to have problems. You need to hit a curveball. And he just couldn't do it. It just wasn't, he wasn't wired that way. And so they had to let him go and brought in a guy who could do it. And so, and it's everything. Like, the internet doesn't work. And in the building or in the part of the building where you are. And, like, that might not seem like a big deal, but we're on our computers 24/7 because you're putting out fires. You're getting email from management about putting people on the guest list. You're getting radio interview requests that need to be fulfilled that day. So you have to interact with them. You also are always kind of prepping for the next batch of shows. So let's say you're in Detroit on Monday. You're going to be in Cleveland on Tuesday and then Kansas City on Wednesday. Like, on Monday, I need to be talking to Kansas City. I need to be telling them what time we show up, like, what I need in the dressing room. And, I mean, they get the email with all of this information. 95% of the time when I showed up, they didn't have anything that we needed.
Wow.
Sometimes you worked with real professionals and it was just, like, the catering was set up at the right time. The dressing rooms were prepped perfectly. They had all the correct food that we asked for, you know, that the band requests on their tour rider. They had the correct amount of towels, but that was rare. And you knew in touring, like, when you got to those venues, you're like, okay, this is going to be a much easier show because we're working with professionals. But, I mean, most of the time, there'd be like four bath towels out, and I'm like, no, I need like hand towels because they sweat on stage and they want to wipe the sweat off them, and they all for whatever reason want five towels each, so I need 25 towels, like 25 hand towels.
Right.
It's just little things like that, and then like the internet wouldn't work, and so then you have to figure out, like, can we hardwire into your Ethernet port somewhere, and like you're pulling plugs, you know, or running a router. Like, from one end of the hallway down to the other just so you can hardwire into it so the printer works, so you can print out guest lists and stuff like that. There's just always problems, and you just have to – you can't say, like, hey, this doesn't work. I don't know what – like, there's nothing we can do. Like, that – you're not going to get anywhere with that response.
Yeah.
It's always like, this is a problem. Here's my idea. What do you think?
Yeah.
And then they – you know, someone says, oh, let's try this, or that's a good idea. Do that. And a lot of it, honestly, anyone who wants to do this can do it, because I didn't know what the hell I was doing, and after a year – of doing it, I looked like a seasoned professional. And I just learned it all on the job. Like, I just asked questions and kind of dove in head first. And you can just figure out a lot of it just diving in and doing it. It's just reps, really. And just not panicking and trying to make things happen and trying to solve problems. And it blows my mind how tours go up. Like how a U2 show will do like the Rose Bowl, because I know how many problems go into shows. It's amazing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they'll just show up, you know, and put up a massive show that day that, you know, thousands of people go to and have a great time, and it looks amazing. You just think these guys are like, you know, rock and roll gods.
And yeah, totally.
It's a lot of the video guy, the lighting guy, the sound guy, the tour manager, the production manager, you know, they put that show together every day, and they're always going to be having problems. And it's a pretty thankless job. Like, the bands love them, but there's no, like, tour manager appreciation award or anything like that.
There's no Academy Award for,
there is, but, like, it's amazing. And, like, you know, these guys and girls work their asses off all year to bring people concerts that they want to go to, and you never see those people. Like, never, you don't know their face or anything. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, that's really cool, though. I'm really glad you shared all that. We're running short on time, so I want to talk a little bit about the music library and about your music specifically. So if you want to talk a little bit about Sonic and Alibi.
Sure. So Sonic was great. It was a great way to learn. It actually also got me my first TV spot.
Do you want to just give a real quick blurb about music libraries for people who don't know?
Yeah, sure. That probably makes more sense. A lot of the music you hear in trailers, like film trailers, backgrounds in reality TV shows and other network shows, the music you hear in advertising, pretty much anywhere that media is attached to music, you're hearing production music. And what a production music library does is it will build a catalog of all different types of genres, usually written specifically for the library by freelance composers that they work with, and they will own that music and license it out to anyone from Disney to an advertising agency to a documentary filmmaker or a mall that's going to, like, you know, needs to play some background music while you're walking around. And so I always thought that when you hear music for a TV promo, you know, like promoting this week's episode of Lost or whatever, that music was written specifically by a composer that worked at ABC.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I thought. I didn't know any better. And then when I started working at Sonic Librarian with Eric, I learned, no, we write that stuff. They just will email and say, I need something that sounds like this. And you listen, you go through the library and you listen to stuff that sounds like what they're asking for, and you send it to them, and they go, cool, we picked this one. And
is it all instrumental, or is it all different kinds?
No,
or
it's all different kinds. There's some vocal, some instrumental. A lot of people don't want vocal because there's a lot of voiceover, whether it's a trailer or an ad. You're hearing someone else's voice, so they want something that's usually, like, not too crazy and doesn't have vocals because the voiceover is going to be there. But occasionally they'll use a vocal on something. And it's every type of genre and subgenre of music you can think of, like gypsy jazz, classic French songs, the big epic trailer music, rock and roll, pop, hip hop, literally like every genre and subgenre under the sun needs to be in your library, because you will get asked for the strangest stuff you've ever heard and you want to pitch for it. So you want to send something. And so that's a lot of how libraries get built up, is they get a client request and for some weird subgenre of music, and they go, hey, we don't have it now, but let's have it in the library in case we ever get asked for this again.
Is that what you're doing now? Are you writing for all different kinds of genres?
I do get to write for Alibi. It just kind of depends on what I'm in the mood to do. Like, I have carte blanche to kind of write whatever I want.
Nice.
But I'm also incredibly busy doing day-to-day operations for Alibi. So writing for the library is tough. But luckily, my boss is really encouraging of my musical career. So I did a short film recently. So that, like, film scoring and writing thematic material attached to characters was always way more of my interest than just, like, coming up with a cue and writing, you know, a 2.5 minute like epic trailer piece. There are a lot of guys that do that infinitely better than I do. So I don't really dive into it as much.
Mm-hmm.
Every once in a while I will just, like, I'll have an idea and I'll just write something. But I'm more interested in, like, longer form narrative work. So I spend a lot more time trying to find those gigs for my music personally.
And how do you find them?
Connections and networking.
Right.
there are sites like Mandy.com that I know people use, and Craigslist and stuff like that. But I just meet people, and mm-hmm. you know, a friend from high school just moved out here, and he went to a networking event. Yeah, he's a businessman, but he met a film producer, and he said, "Oh, you know, my best friend from high school, he's out here. He dabbles in film composing." So she said, "Put us in touch." And she and I went to coffee, and I got home after coffee, and she'd introed me to 10 people. It was really awesome. Like, that's rare. But through that, I meet other people, and they have projects that they're working on, and I'll send them music, and they, if they like it, they'll say, "Hey, can you write something for me?" And you do it, you get paid for it. It's really fun and really rewarding. But again, I've never gotten a composing gig where I just, like, applied for it. Someone vouched for me, and that's also the name of the game for writing. Mm-hmm. People need to vouch for you. The phrase I always use is, you need someone to fight for you in the room.
Yeah.
And if it's you and four other composers who are up for a gig, and someone in there knows you and likes you and says, "Hey, we should go with Tim," you have a really good chance of getting that gig. And it has nothing to do with talent. It doesn't mean that you're better than those four people. You could all be the exact same talent level. The
yeah.
reason why you got it was because someone fought for you in the room. So that's how I try to get gigs, just meeting people and trying to be nice and pick their brain and learn about them and what they want to do and how I can be of service, hopefully.
Yeah. And how do you write? Do you use, like, a program like Logic or Ableton? What do you, or Pro Tools?
I'm a Logic user. That's uh-huh. my DAW. And I didn't really play piano until I got to Berkeley, and now I practice every day because my piano chops are really, really bad. But I write on the piano. Like, I try to write. A composer mentor friend told me I should always write in a neutral color. He's like, the only good one is the piano. He's like, you can try to write on guitar, but I don't know how successful you'd be. But he said, try to write in a neutral color and develop your inner ear. So that way, like, when you write a line that you want to be played on a French horn, like, think about it in your head, like, how they're going to phrase it, how they're going to play it. Sample libraries these days are amazing, but people tend to write to their strength of their sample library.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be very limiting, I feel. And I also think that because all these libraries sound so great and it doesn't take a lot of TLC to make your track sound amazing, a lot of the music I'm hearing sounds very homogenous. And so I try to focus on, like, how do I become a better writer? And then I'll use these tools to make what I do better instead of saying, how do I get better at using these tools? If that makes sense.
Yeah. Totally. Totally. That's great.
Yeah. And so, like, for just in terms of workflow, like, for the short film I did, I had the film was locked when I got it, which means, like, it was done being edited. They weren't going to change any scenes or make stuff shorter or take anything out. And I wrote the main theme for the characters first, and then I started at the beginning of the film and then wrote all the way through. And it's a lot scarier than I want it to be every single time I write something. Like, I'm always really nervous. And I've heard this from, like, big composers and little composers as well, or I should say younger, inexperienced composers and little composers. But it's like there's this part in your brain that you always think, like, I don't know if I can do this. Like, what the hell am I thinking? Like, why did I say I could do this? And then you just kind of start writing and you click on something. And then I go the opposite way where I get a little arrogant. And I'm like, oh, this is the best piece of music ever. And then 20 minutes, and then after the director hears it, I'm like, I hate it. Like, just take my music out, please. So it's this constant inner struggle between, like, I am very good and I'm the worst thing that's ever happened to music. So
yeah, I think it's pretty common.
Yeah, I think so too. Definitely do. And, you know, my whole thing is kind of harkening back to the marathon eureka moment. Like, you kind of have that road to Damascus flash of like, holy shit, like my life could have been over in a heartbeat and there was nothing I could do about it. Mm-hmm. And that's a very kind of violating feeling, but it was also very freeing. And so every time I sit down at the piano to write, I kind of go into that mindset like, look, you're lucky to be here. You're lucky to be doing this. Just have fun with it and try to write something that is meaningful to you and hopefully to the director. And when you hit on something special that they gravitate towards, it is like the only other rush that I can describe it to is when, like, I was playing in a band and, like, the lights would go out and people would cheer and you'd walk out. Like, I would just get, like, an adrenaline rush. And it's very similar to that. Not as high intensity as playing up on stage, but like you do get like a little bit of adrenaline rush when the director's like, I love that. Like, that's fantastic, because it's almost like a magic trick, right? Like, you pulled this out of thin air and you wrote something that they feel elevates their characters or the scene. And it's like, that's a really beautiful thing.
Yeah. What was the name of the short film?
It's called Charlie. We just finished post and I'm very excited about it. It was a struggle because the tone of the film changes at times and it deals with mental illness. And it was something I wanted to treat with a lot of respect. I didn't want it to sound like scary. Cause I think that's really dismissive. But it also had to be tense at times. And so finding that harmonic balance was difficult, but, the director who I've known for years, she was at Emerson when I was at Berkeley and we lived in the same apartment building. And gosh, I think 9 years later, we ended up doing a project together, which is really cool. She was, you know, very, very encouraging of me trying stuff and if she didn't like something, it wasn't because I wasn't good enough. It just didn't fit. Yeah. And I talked to Michael Abels, who did the film Get Out. He was the composer on Get Out. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you can't be afraid of hearing no. He was like, when I worked with Jordan Peele, I would write something. He's like, that's great. And then I played something else and he would go, no, that's not right. It doesn't work. And he's like, that was Michael's first film. And he was like, at first I was really nervous. Like, oh God, I'm going to get fired. Cause he doesn't like this. And that's not the case. Like, you're going to hear no.
Right.
So you just have to go, okay, cool. No worries. I get it. And then just write something else.
Yeah, totally. Like, don't get too attached to your babies.
Yeah, right. And it's funny, right? Some of the stuff you really like gets cut, and something you're like, it's a throwaway, is like the director's favorite. So you never know.
Totally. All right, well, we're almost just out of time, but I wanted to give let you get a quick word in about what's coming down the pike for you with your music. I know that there's going to be a possible future tour coming up. Anything else that you want to share?
Yeah, so that record should be done. That'll go out. We're going to hopefully tour England. Another old band that I loved being in as I graduated from Berkeley, we were called the Painted Lights. I was inspired by the fact that the Baby Strange guys came out and we did a record. So I went to Boston, and the Painted Lights, we just did an EP that we're mixing right now that I love.
Nice.
So we're going to be putting that out. I'm going to try and get that licensed on TV and stuff, maybe make a little bit of money off it. Hoping to do Melanie, who's the director of Charlie. She's working on a horror film script right now. We're going to try and get that made. So just trying to be busy and write and enjoy life and enjoy this crazy journey that I've been on that took a bunch of weird winding turns and then put me on the path I'm at now. And I feel very successful. And,
I'd agree with that.
Thank you. Yeah, been a really, like, I don't have much monetary value to show for it, but I've had just the most amazing experiences, and it was never what I thought it was going to be. It was never how I thought it was going to go down. It's been just an incredible ride so far.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as an artist, you know, the ultimate surrender that I think we have to make is, you know, surrender to the outcome. Like, we're just supposed to
do the actions and create the output, and then the outcome or the reaction or the reception is kind of like none of our business, you know? So
absolutely. Yeah. I always say you just have to surrender to the void. You don't know what's going to happen. And so you just have to do that.
Exactly.
I think this podcast is really cool. I think anyone who is interested in music as a career should be made aware, and they are through your efforts. Like, there's a million different ways you can have a career and make money in music, whether you're writing it or you're managing it or you're publishing it or you're putting up a show. You can have a career and have a really enjoyable career. You should just surrender to the void and be open to tons of different opportunities and possibilities of what that career might look like. And you never know, you could land in something that you never even dreamt of as being a job. And before you know it, like, it's your dream job. So surrender to the void and just go for it.
I love it. Well, thank you so much, Tim. I all the insight on, you know, how the sausage is made on tours to music libraries and beyond, and, you know, rocking out with the band. So thank you again so much. It's been such a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I hope I gave you some good answers and some good insight. And I really appreciate your efforts, and thanks for having me. I feel very privileged to be here.
That's just such a great rock star story, hanging out with Wiz Khalifa and running around with Mick Jones and talking to Slash. Just some great stuff there. And I also have to laugh because Tim is, what, 33, and he's already managed to cram in about 3 different lifetimes into his career. And he's just warming up. So excited to see what the next several chapters will bring for Tim. You can actually follow him on his SoundCloud page. It's Franchised Youth is the name of his SoundCloud. So it would be soundcloud.com/franchised, FranchisedYouth. If you just track them on there, and then you can keep track of also when Baby Strange is going to go on tour and new releases and stuff like that. So that's where to follow him, and be sure to check that out. Okay, my love, so we're getting to the end of episode 11, and I hope everybody has checked out the earlier episodes, other amazing interviews and stories and musical journeys to hear about and get inspired by. If you want to hear about my music and my stuff going on, you can check me out at lariel-music.com. That's lariel-music.com. I'm also on the Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and all that good stuff. Okay, babies. So again, have a wonderful week. Take good care. And remember to keep on hustling. Pursue that dream. Don't give up.